Sunday House Call is presented by Robillard Hearing Centers for all the moments that are yours to live.
From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 348 of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. I'm broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa in a special two-hour edition of Sunday House Call, as we had last week, especially with heading into the election. I want to generate not only questions about your own health and some answers that you would like and explaining how diseases work and how we treat them, but also to deal with healthcare issues, especially as it pertains to the election and how, for the most part, our political parties are missing the ball on where the problems lie. And it always seems to be spending more money without really looking at the outcomes. And in fact, the outcomes tending to be the same. And with that in mind, we have coming up in just a couple of minutes, Brett Skinner. He is the president and director of health policy studies at the Fraser Institute. He wrote an article in conjunction with Mark Revere of the Fraser Institute that was published in the National Post this past Tuesday, and it was entitled Get Health Reform Off the Waiting List. We're going to get into that and also a lot of the other studies that Mr. Skinner has done over the years. He's been on our show every year for the most part for the past 6 or 7 years now. And so I thought it would be a very good idea to have him on, especially during this time, during the election, when people want to discuss healthcare. It is the number one area that they wish to review, and no one is really talking about it. So we'll be doing that and also taking your calls after the interview at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And coming right up, Brett Skinner. And joining us today is Brett Skinner, President and Director of Health Policy Studies at the Fraser Institute. And welcome back, Brett.
Yeah, glad to be back on your show again, Dr. Dworkin.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on because I really have read all the studies that you have produced over the years. And in a nutshell, we like to look at evidence. We like to look at the data, find out where the data comes from, what it means, look at it dispassionately, not apply ideology to it. And so what I wanted to start off with, first off, is what you use when you're writing your reports. What are your data sources and what has been demonstrated by this over the years that you've been compiling it?
Well, we typically use publicly available sources of data so that, you know, your listeners and people who read the reports can verify the data for themselves as factual. Our recent study that we've done measuring the sustainability of health spending in Canada uses publicly available data published by the provincial governments themselves. It's from the provincial economic accounts, and it's actually posted on Statistics Canada's websites. We also use data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is, or people refer to it as the OECD. It's based out of Paris, and it's an international organization which retains data from governments around the world about economic performance, and issues like healthcare are included in their databases.
And are their databases considered to be of high quality?
Yeah, these are the most authoritative sources for data that we have on Canadian data, StatsCan, CIHI, et cetera. And the OECD is the most authoritative source of international comparative data between countries.
So I want to divide this up into different areas. The first is to deal with what you mentioned just before, the rate of healthcare spending, where it's going, how it's affecting the provinces with regards to their capacity to cover the cost of healthcare, how the demographics affect that, then go on to how wait times have been managed, and also just overall how we compare to other countries with regards to our system and solutions proposed to make things work better. So my first question would be, what has been the trend with regards to expenses? What is happening in this country?
Well, you know, we look at this over the last 10-year trend period. So we take 10 years of available data on actual historical experience of provincial government health expenditures in Canada. We look at the growth rate of provincial health spending relative to the growth rate in total available provincial revenues, and that would include federal transfers available mm-hmm. to the provinces. And what we find is that health spending in the provinces is growing much faster than available revenues, which means health spending is growing faster than our ability to pay for it through public means alone. This is actually a long-term trend. We've looked at data going back to 1975, and we find that health spending in the provinces has grown faster than revenues over that period of time. It's also grown faster than GDP over that period of time. So this is a systemic problem that's been going on in Canada for a long time. Governments have dealt with this in a number of ways over the years, all of which have been unproductive and have not solved the problem. They've borrowed money and over several years run up significant deficits of greater frequency since the early 1970s. And when that became fiscally unsustainable, governments began to raise taxes. And mm-hmm. when that became economically unsustainable, they rationed access. And when that became medically unsustainable, they've now gone to a zero-sum trade-off game in which health spending is crowding out other important government priorities and services, and that I predict will be politically unsustainable.
So when back in, I believe it was 2004, when the proposal was to provide a 10-year funding plan of $42 billion to inject into the system, has that had any impact?
Yeah, often people will say, well, what if we spend more federal transfers on the system? Isn't that the problem? And it's really not the problem. The federal government has been extremely generous to the provinces over the last 10 years, spending more than $36 billion, more than needed to keep up with population growth, $36 billion more than needed to keep up with normal inflation growth in the health sector. So we really are seeing a situation which, despite a high degree of support from the federal government, provincial governments will not rein in their expenditures. They will avoid making the necessary reforms to contain expenditures. And despite having all those federal transfers at their disposal, health spending continues to grow faster than total available revenues in the provinces, including those transfers.
We're in discussion with Brett Skinner regarding our healthcare system and healthcare expenditures. Brett Skinner is Director of Health Policy Studies at the Fraser Institute. And we will be back right after the break to continue this discussion. And again, I encourage you to call thereafter at 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Any comments and questions you have will be greatly accepted, unlike Premier McGuinty, who again tells us that we are intellectually bankrupt. We'll be back right after the break.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Welcome back. We're in conversation with Brett Skinner, President and Director of Health Policy Studies at the Fraser Institute. And Brett, I wanted to, because frankly, I have difficulty understanding this when I hear percentages of GDP and what that actually means and how that is used when you're comparing, for example, provincial expenditures, countries' expenditures, because I think for a lot of our listeners, they look at the total amount that is being spent, the billions of dollars. And when percentage GDP is mentioned, sort of, and I know my eyes glaze over, because what does this actually mean?
When you're thinking about how much a country spends as a percentage of its GDP on healthcare, it's really sort of an irrelevant question in a way, because the main question is mm-hmm. what is the value for money received? So if a country spends a lot on healthcare, does it get a lot in return relative to its competitor or comparative countries?
Right.
Canada tends to spend a lot relative to countries that are similar to it, but tends to get very little in return. We're the sixth most expensive country among 28 countries in the OECD. These are countries that have the same social goals that we have for healthcare. They have similar levels of economic development. We're the sixth most expensive. Now, if you adjust for the age of our population, which tends to be younger than those other populations, mm-hmm. Then we actually spend more. In terms of rank would rise from sixth to second mm-hmm. Most expensive. That's just simply because health expenditures tend to rise with age, and so if you have a more aged population, you would expect to spend more. In Canada's population being younger, we should expect to spend less, but in fact we spend more. But despite spending more, sixth overall among 28 OECD countries, mm-hmm. We rank far below sixth on both 16 out of 18 indicators of access to healthcare goods and services. So we ranked, for instance, 20th out of 22 available countries where data was available. 20th out of 22 for practicing physicians per 1,000 population. Mm-hmm. So for the number of physicians that are available to people, we rank very low. Same with CT scanners. You know, diagnostic technologies like CT scanners, MRI units, the number of mammographs performed per population, the number of surgeries performed in various categories, the number of curative care beds available to the population. We rank far below all of these countries, and yet we're spending almost at the top ranks in terms of overall spending as a percentage of GDP. What we would expect if we were spending that much mm-hmm. and we had an efficient system is to also rank high in the other categories of access to physicians and diagnostic devices and surgeries and so on and so forth.
So how do other countries manage their systems when they are, in general, spending less than we are? What is it that they're doing differently? And what are their indicators in terms of healthcare outcomes? How are they faring?
Most of the countries in the OECD fare very comparably to each other in terms of actual health outcomes for those people who can get access to health care. Mm-hmm. And that's really how that should be measured. But if you look at what they do differently, all of these countries, to one degree or another, allow user-based funding or exposure to cost-sharing for patients when they access or make use of publicly insured goods and services. So if someone makes use of a visit to the doctor's office, or they buy a low-cost generic drug, and these are affordable expenditures for most people, they face some sort of an out-of-pocket cost for that. They're insured for almost all of the cost, as mm-hmm. they are in our system, but they're exposed to a small percentage of it, and that creates proper incentives for economic use of the system, for efficiencies. They also allow people the option, if they choose to exercise it, to buy parallel private health insurance for the things that are already insured publicly. So things like physician services and hospital services. In Canada, that's banned. You're not allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the difference of our system between us and them. The other thing is there's a lot of competition from various provider sources for the delivery of publicly funded goods and services, and that's also not commonly made use of in Canada. So there's three main differences, the lack of user charges in Canada, the lack of the option for parallel private health insurance, and the lack of competition for the delivery of publicly funded goods and services. That is the major difference between us and them.
So has there been, because one of the arguments is that if you have a user-based fee, that you will dissuade those that are of less financial means from using the system if they need to access the system. Has that been borne out by any evidence in those countries?
No, in fact, the evidence shows just the opposite. These countries, of course, as I've mentioned, have the same social goal we do, to provide universal access to medically necessary care, and they achieve that goal with virtually no wait times and a high degree of access to medical resources. There's also some research been done out of Harvard University by a group of economists there. It's really the largest experiment of its kind in history, where mm-hmm. people were put into various kinds of insurance programs. They were exposed to various degrees of out-of-pocket payments, and they found that they could reduce overall use of health care by about 30% with no negative outcomes no negative health outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so what this told the researchers is that there was a lot of unnecessary use, but there were exceptions. People with high blood pressure or diabetes, conditions that required a regular preventative access to primary care physicians, those folks could be helped by reducing the out-of-pocket exposure so they face fewer barriers to accessing care.
Now, you mentioned wait times as well, and with all the emphasis being put on diverting and devoting resources towards certain wait time areas, how have we done? Again, what has the data shown with regards to wait times in our country?
Yeah, wait times tend to be extraordinarily long in Canada, and that's a very unique situation in the OECD. The countries that I like to look at, like Germany, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Belgium, these countries have virtually no wait times at all. Maybe you're talking a day or so for an administrative wait just to schedule the procedure and make sure that there's someone available. But you know, in Canada, we're talking wait times of 9.3 weeks on average across 12 major specialties. Back in 1993, that has since doubled by 2010 to 18.2 weeks on average CHI reports long wait times in Canada relative to other countries around the world. The kinds of policies I mentioned, the user charges, the parallel private health insurance, the competition for the delivery of goods and services, those are the kinds of things that introduce appropriate economic incentives into the healthcare system, and that leads to better delivery, and that reduces wait times. That provides more sustainable resources over time, and it creates incentives for people to economize on their use of healthcare.
With regards to the, again, the increasing cost, and you made mention earlier that, you know, in some provinces it's half the budget. When you take out federal transfers, and I believe you said it was, in the paper, it was it Nova Scotia at 88% of their budget?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dr. Dworkin. The data shows that because health spending has been growing faster than total available revenues in the provinces over time, that Ontario and Quebec are already over 50%. So that means that in Ontario and Quebec, those provincial governments are spending more than 50% of their total available revenues on healthcare today. 10 years ago, it was 40%. Back in 75, it was 25%. So it's increasing over time. And it's not just Ontario and Quebec. There are six other provinces who will reach the 50% mark by 2017, or in about 6 years. So what's happening is that health spending is crowding out other government priorities, other government priorities for spending, as it consumes larger and larger shares of the budget. And you're absolutely right. When you take away federal transfers, if you look at this without federal transfers, provinces like Nova Scotia are staring bankruptcy in the face. There's roughly 88% of provincial own source revenues minus federal transfers that are spent on healthcare today. And it's rising over time. And finance ministers, health ministers across the country recognize that sustainability is the core issue in healthcare today.
What has the reaction been from the public and from people who have the wherewithal to make some change with regards to the report that you produced?
Well, first let me point out to your listeners that the International Monetary Fund, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, TD Economics, the C.D. Howe Institute, other major groups have all come out and said that sustainability is a serious crisis facing Canada. And that's the kinds of policies that we've recommended in our reports are actually the kinds of policies that the IMF and the OECD are also recommending. So there's a lot of people, a long list of people that I actually list in our study that have been saying similar things over the years. So there's a consensus here that's developed, and I think it points to the urgency. But the reaction we're getting, I think, is very positive, because what we've actually recommended is that the federal government temporarily suspend the Canada Health Act provisions that prevent user-based private sector financing for healthcare. The provinces currently can't engage in those kinds of policies because they're prohibited by the Canada Health Act. We're asking the federal government to temporarily suspend the act for 5 years to allow the provinces to experiment with those policies that are common in other countries without risking the withdrawal of federal transfers.
And how have people reacted?
Well, we've got an endorsement by the editorial staff at the Ottawa Citizen, who published an endorsement of that approach. We're getting good responses, from the public. But we're really just trying to educate people that there's nothing radical in these policy proposals. They're common in other countries. All the evidence, our experience in those countries, and all the evidence that we have from economics suggests that they will work. We're very confident in that. We're saying, let's give it a chance. It's a low-risk way of giving it a chance. If it doesn't work out, we go right back to the status quo after 5 years. But we're very confident this will improve the sustainability of the healthcare system. It'll provide a more sustainable source of resources for the system. It will introduce appropriate incentives for economizing on the use of the healthcare system. These are things that I say, you know, are not radical in other countries, but something we should be trying here in Canada.
Brett Skinner is President and Director of Health Policy Studies at the Fraser Institute. And Brett, once again, thank you so much for taking the time, especially on an Easter Sunday, to talk about these issues. I think it gives people a lot of information to think about. And as always, I'm likely going to have you back on the air again to talk about this, because I don't think this issue is going to go away.
Thanks, Dr. Dworkin. It is an important issue. If you care about debts, deficits, taxes, and access for patients, you got to pay attention to the sustainability of healthcare spending in Canada.
Brett, all the best.
Take care.
And we'll be back with your calls, 521-TALK, 521-8255, *58 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, back right after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call,
News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Welcome back to our two-hour extended version of Sunday House Call here till 6 p.m. and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Are the numbers to call. Any comments you may have on the interview with Brett Skinner from the Fraser Institute regarding their proposals with regards to trying to essentially save our healthcare system because of the direction that it's going and the costs that are being incurred. You may have other ideas about it, and that's absolutely fine. I'm not here to argue with anybody. I want to hear ideas. I want to hear what you have to think about it, what you would propose, what you see the problems being, and what you see the good things are. Let's face it, it still does help people, and so we want to know what we can do to make things better and try to think about things aside from ideology, because that is what we're getting from our provincial government, is an ideological response that refuses to listen to anything that is outside of that their framework for healthcare, which is unfortunate because there are many ways to provide health care for everybody, that you have universal coverage. So, again, your comments are appreciated. And any other medical topic, if you'd like to bring that up, you certainly are free to do so. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And we're going to go to line one and welcome Nicholas from Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hi. Very glad you have Fraser Institute on the program. I read their first report about 15 years ago,
right,
where they used about 15 or 20 criteria, which showed that our health care was pretty crappy, best mediocre on some criteria, really crappy on others. There's no rocket science here. I mean, we've got a very poor healthcare system in train here. And the question is, what are we going to do about it?
Correct.
Well, we've been talking about this for, 25 years, and Fraser got aboard and exposed the whole damn thing as what a fiasco it was. And the question, what are we going to do about it? Well, provincial and federal governments are absolutely impervious to any common sense, any reason, any basic good sense.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is I'd be very impressed if I saw the doctors, medical profession, picketing hospitals, picketing departments of health, being our advocates. I think they're very poor advocates.
Mm-hmm.
All they're doing is trying to work within the system and using their associations as a unionized bargaining agent.
Mm-hmm.
They're not picking up any of the tab on this crappy health care. Why aren't they out there picketing? That's what I'd like to know. And you're exceptional in the sense of you are trying to act as an advocate here. But, I mean, if I saw a couple of hundred doctors or 50 or so doctors picketing the Ottawa hospital because I have to wait 6 months,
mm-hmm.
6 months, if you can believe it,
mm-hmm.
to get my first appointment to see a specialist to deal with my diabetes. 6 months? That's a crime.
It is a long time.
That's a crime.
Yeah.
That's not just a long time. That's disgusting and criminal. And, we need these doctors to get out there and picket. The other thing is, of course, we don't have any information. I mean, in the United States, there's a magazine called U.S. News and World Report,
mm-hmm.
which publishes a rating on about 15 or 20 criteria for every hospital.
Yeah, and so you know what's going on.
How many guys are dying?
Mm-hmm.
How many, in one hospital compared to another? You know, that's criminal for that information to be hidden from us.
And they do that in Europe as well, where they will publish how well procedures are done so people can choose the institution they wish to go to.
Exactly.
So that they know they're getting the best care for the money that they're spending through their insurance.
I mean, you know, it's inexcusable to the government can't run anything right. They're a bunch of dumb cops that can't be fired no matter what they do. Can't be fired no matter what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And, in the States, people avoid second-rate lousy hospitals. By looking up the U.S. News and World Report thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the kind of idiocy and criminal incompetence on the part of the government was exemplified writ large about 10 or 15 years ago when they were consolidating the hospitals into large hospitals. In the States, they stopped doing large hospitals about 30 years ago.
They're doing more specialized centers.
Yeah, exactly. And but what did these idiots in the departments of health do in the case of Ottawa? They closed down the most efficient hospital,
mm-hmm.
which had the lowest bed cost and the highest efficiency of operations, which was the Salvation Army Hospitals. And, why aren't people getting fired? I mean, they've got, programs where the staff, including the doctors and the nurses, mm-hmm. refuse to use these hand washing, sanitization. They refuse to do it. And, and they finally, do publish reports on this from time to time. So what do we get? They say we're going to put a big campaign on to encourage nurses and doctors. Why not fire them if they don't?
Well, it's an interesting point you're making, Nicholas, except if you fire too many of them, then you have even less people providing care.
Well,
it's
I
a
think
vicious
they'd
circle
start sanitizing themselves rather than get fired.
But you do raise a good point in that, there has to be a certain level of professionalism when you're treating patients and you have to minimize the spread of infection. So
of course,
I mean, absolutely agree with you on that.
These clowns can't get fired even for refusing to take basic medical preventative medical procedures, the doctors and the nurses. It's disgusting. Can't get fired no matter what they do.
Well, Nicholas,
we've got to get some doctors out there picketing the hospitals.
I think one of the issues with picketing is that what will tend to happen is the message will likely get mutated by opposition forces and special interest groups to portray any group that sticks their neck out there as in it for themselves,
well,
the usual,
where...
and I'm sure you've seen that before, Nicholas, where you have people who do make a point, and then the name calling starts, and instead of dealing
that's
with the issues,
courage and integrity come in when you ignore the fools, like this NDP guy. He's out there trying to get the Sikhs to vote for him. He should be out there, and he's against any improvements in our system that were recommended by anyone with a brain, dual parallel systems mm-hmm. and so on. They've got to start picketing the fools.
Well, Nicholas, I'd like to thank you for your comments. I have a lot of other callers right now, but I appreciate your input.
Well, I hope some doctors will get out there and picket and advocate on our behalf instead of just taking in their money.
Thanks a lot, Nicholas.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And what I think we'll do is we're going to take a small break, about a minute early, and then when we get back, Anna in Montreal has some questions, has some comments about healthcare. And then we have Bill in Nepean, wants to talk about spinal stenosis. Tony in Ottawa, pain in his right hand. And Garnet in Ottawa about hip replacements. 521 Talk, 520-255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. Looking forward to speaking with you. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
And we're going straight back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Anna in Montreal.
Hello?
Hello, Anna.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling to make a comment. I heard Dr. Skinner's
Brett Skinner, yeah.
Summary of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some concerns. I recognize that our health system is in deep need of improvement.
Okay.
That is evident. There's lack of care, there's denied health care to patients, there's deferred health care to patients, there are waiting times that are unacceptable. There's a lot that is going wrong, and there is, most of all, a lot of unaccountability,
mm-hmm.
both in hospitals and the system overall. However, what I wonder about is I am quite concerned when I hear about contributions and privatizing, all these other words. These are buzzwords to we come to you hat in hand to collect. I want to point out that we're all paying 40 cents on the dollar here, every dollar we earn into this system.
Mm-hmm.
So they better deliver. It's not a matter of choice. Now, if we privatize, they will have an excellent private system, and they will have the faulty system that we have right now getting worse. That is, it's going to be a parallel between private schools and public schools, the same thing. Private schools teaching, public schools giving you the bare minimum. I'm not even sure you're going to get the bare minimum if they can tell you, well, this is the way we do it around here. You have an option. Go pay for it.
Well, I think your point is very well taken, Anna. What I would say is that no one is proposing that kind of system. In fact, what the proposal is to look at other countries in Europe that do things where they have dual systems. But what
do you mean dual system? Well, dual what and what?
Okay. Well, what they have is they have institutions that provide care, and everybody is mandated to have insurance. For example, the Netherlands, when they changed their system in 2006. They had a system that was very similar to ours. They had the similar problems that we had. What they then said is the government said, we're getting out of the insurance company business. We are going to mandate specific oversight with regards to how care should be provided. That is, the regulations necessary to ensure proper care. They made sure.
My idea is that it has nothing to do with regulations. It has everything to do with management.
Anna, you are not letting me finish. If we want to have a discussion, please let me finish, and then I will give you a chance to talk. Okay.
Yeah.
So what they did in the Netherlands is everybody was mandated to have insurance. So those that can afford the insurance bought insurance. Those that could not afford it, the government purchased it for them. And then they chose the insurance, and regardless of their health status, even if they had specific diseases, the law was passed that the insurance companies had to cover those conditions as well. They weren't kept out of the loop with regards to who was covered for particular conditions. On the basis of that, what the Netherlands has found is that there is universal coverage. No one is left out. Waiting times are down to zero. There is, as you have rightly pointed out, there is accountability on the part of hospitals because all the outcomes now are available online for people to compare how an institution is doing, whether it is a public hospital or a private hospital. It is all there for people to see and choose where they want to go. No one is paying extra out of pocket because the taxes that they were paying for their health care to the government are now directed to the insurance companies. So in terms of the amount that they are paying, they are not paying any more than they were before. The difference is that the government mandates that people have to be treated, you can't refuse them, and that the level of care has to be this standard. So they set the standards. That's what's going on in that country, and no one is going without health care. So if the concern is that you're going to have different populations with different access, what I would suggest to you today is that this is exactly what our system is doing now, in that it is having people who, regardless of their problem, can work their way through the system depending on who they know. They can go and purchase insurance for various other things that other people cannot afford. So they can have dentists that are covered. They can have physiotherapy, chiropractic, critical illness insurance, life insurance, medications covered, and other people cannot. So we already have multiple tiers in our system to begin with. So the idea that we're somehow going to switch to a more tiered system is, I would have to say, not correct, because we have that already.
I believe that we have equally bad care for everybody. It's very equal and very bad. I believe that in France, for example, whether you are Canadian, American, French, you walk into a hospital, you're immediately treated. Mm-hmm. Regardless, nobody asks you where you come from, nobody asks you for money.
Okay.
Not only that, but the medication is covered too. And it is all public. It doesn't have to be private. It doesn't have to be contributed to. It is properly managed. It's a system that is properly managed. And what's more is each doctor is accountable for his own patient. You walk into a hospital here in Canada, there's nobody accountable. They walk in packs of five minimum. And then they change. They rotate. Every week there's another team.
Mm-hmm.
And the team is how they manage to not be accountable.
Well, Anna, you do raise very good points. What I would have to say is that in France, they also have a private system as well. So it's not just all public. All the European countries have a mixture of public and private systems. So it's not just public that exists in France. But you make a good point that the service is excellent there. So what I would suggest is, and respectfully so, is that what is wrong with looking at how other countries do things? If your main objective is to have a more efficient system, to have a system that responds to the needs of its population, that functions with more accountability, there are other countries that are doing that now. Why do we don't have to reinvent the wheel?
There is no standard of care in Canada.
But you're not answering my question. My question is, why do we not adopt systems that work very well in other countries that provide universal coverage? So I'm not talking about people being left out, that provide universal coverage, better accountability, better health outcomes, when we don't have to reinvent the wheel, when there are millions and millions of people using a different system that works very well for them. Why can we not adopt some of what they do and bring that here?
Because if we are going to apply the system the same way we apply our own system, it's going to be just as faulty because we can't manage it. It doesn't matter what system we bring in, we will be incompetent at managing it properly.
We do
not have accountability. We do not have standards. We do not have follow-ups. We do not have the basics.
Inherent in adopting a new system means that you have accountability standards. It's not a matter of bringing in a system with the same overview. If you're going to change things, and I agree with you, you have to change how the system functions so that the new mechanism that you've introduced and how care is provided functions the way it's supposed to. And so what I am saying is that you bring in exactly the same ways, the same means of assessing accountability, how the system functions, and you incorporate that. To say that we mismanage everything is nihilistic, because in other words, it means that it doesn't matter what we do, nothing's going to be any better. And what I would say is that we have to try something, as opposed to throwing up our hands and saying we're all corrupt and nothing is ever going to change.
What I'm proposing is that we look at ourselves and see how we do things.
But we've been trying
to see how we are missing what we're doing, because the system could work.
Anna, the system, Anna, the system does not work, and that was the whole idea behind the information presented. The system is not working. It doesn't matter how much money we put into it, what layers of bureaucracy we put into this to try and manage it. It is falling apart. And my question has been, we cannot keep doing the same thing, asking for the same kind of results, when the evidence has been that we have not made any strides in making our system work any better. And to deny the evidence that what other countries provide to their citizens on the basis of making an assumption that everything is corrupt here, and so therefore bringing it here is going to be, people are going to be just as corrupt, is
no,
not going
not
to forward anything.
I'm not saying corrupt, I'm saying incompetent. There's a difference.
Whether you're saying corrupt or incompetent, the point is, if everybody is incompetent, how do you expect anything to change? Because in other words, if everybody is incompetent, doesn't matter what you do. Well, no, yeah, but they're all incompetent, so how are they going to be educated? That's the point.
Well, you have ways of educating people and establishing standards.
Right.
And establishing...
I have to respectfully disagree with you, Anna. I don't think everybody in our country is incompetent. Just like Premier McGuinty thinks that we're all intellectually bankrupt, I don't think that everybody is incompetent. And so therefore, the notion that somehow any system that we introduce into here will somehow be mismanaged, I just don't buy it. I think that people are at a point where they want to see change, and when that comes about, people want this to happen, it will happen. But it will take pressure from the public to be able to do this. We're going to take a small break and come back for our second hour. I thank Anna for her call. Very stimulating discussion. 521 Talk, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. You're listening to Sunday House Call, back right after the news.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Into the second hour of our show, heading to 6 p.m., and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Are the numbers to call. Any comments or questions that you might have? In the last hour, we talked about healthcare and our healthcare system and proposals to how we change it, reservations about how our system, as it stands now, may not be able to adapt to that change if we don't change how we approach managing our system. Anna from Montreal made some very good comments, and I appreciate her comments about how... I guess because of how our system has been run for so long, that there are concerns about how well it's being managed, and that if the same managers take over and we introduce another system, that we may end up with the same thing. And it's a valid point. What I would have to say is that if you're going to make significant changes, then it likely will mean you'll have to have different people oversee that, as opposed to having the same people who have been doing the same thing over and over again and committing the same errors, resulting in very little change and very little bang for our buck. And we're going to go to some very patient callers. We have Bill in Nepean. Good afternoon, Bill.
Good afternoon, Doctor. First of all, I had a question on spinal stenosis.
But yes.
I have to concur fully in your guest and yourself on the fact that we do need a change. And what's being recommended sounds reasonable to me. The study of other countries and take the best out of those countries.
Absolutely.
And make our system work. Our system is good when it does work. We have good people. I've been in the hospital for hip operation. We have good people, good doctors, good nurses, but it's the people that can't get at the system or are not able to utilize the system when they need it that's hurting. And it's because of the over... And you're right. The government, as it stands now, has been pouring billions of dollars into it, and the money is not being well used. So if we can have a system studied, and if the government would allow it, I think would be beneficial to all of us users.
Well, I certainly hope so, because my concern is that if we keep going in a direction without changing, the same direction, the system just cannot... And as Mr. Skinner mentioned, it's just, it cannot be sustained the way it is going. You know, you look at how provincial budgets are being strained, you will end up delisting or restricting or reducing the number of medications available, procedures that are available per year. And this happens because you start running out of money, you have to ration care. So my concern is that we're going to end up with a drastic curtailment of these services, because when the money runs out, things fall apart pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
And I think we need to be proactive about it and say, look, let's look at the data dispassionately. Let's look at what other countries are doing. We're not proposing any system that's going to leave anybody behind. We are comparing apples to apples with universal systems. They are all United States does not count because it is not a universal system. So that's not part of the equation. It's not even the system that's being looked at. We're looking at other countries that provide care for all their population, how they do it. Does it provide better results? If it does, that's what should really matter. Who cares how it's organized if everybody gets coverage and everybody gets faster service and your outcomes and your health outcomes are better? Isn't that what we should be shooting for?
Yes, we should be. And hopefully we can aim in that direction and everybody get behind the project, and including the government. My question is on behalf of my wife.
Sure.
She was recently diagnosed with spinal stenosis.
Yes.
When you try to read up on that condition, it's very scary to say the least. Right now she's on Tylenol for pain because she's not able to take other type of medication.
Okay.
And that doesn't really provide the full pain relief. My questions are, how fast does something of this nature, it's in the lower back,
mm-hmm.
progress, and what are the options for treatment, and what other pain medication is available to give a person that really all they can take is Tylenol, or is there anything else?
There are other medications. Now, does she have an allergy to a specific medication or an intolerance? What?
She just appears to have the intolerance for...
She gets nauseated.
Yes.
Okay. So there are...
Well, not nauseated. It just... Uh-huh. Whatever it is, it seems to disagree with her system when she takes anti-inflammatories.
Okay. Has she used any... Has she used any other kind of pain relievers?
Like, she has some Lyrica, and she still has tablets of those. But
okay.
Basically, no, she's not using any kind of other medication.
Okay. Well, spinal stenosis, as for our listeners, is a narrowing of the spinal canal that can squeeze on the nerve, the nerves within the spinal cord. And
right.
Depending on the level of the area affected, it's usually in the lower back. Most of the time with spinal stenosis, it doesn't cause any long-term nerve damage. So that's the good thing about this.
Yes.
The issue then becomes, how do we manage the pain? How do we improve mobility? How do we ensure that a person has a good quality of life as things heal up?
Yes.
So, yeah, Tylenol in and of itself, not going to do too much. Usually you have to use combinations of things. I heard you mentioned Lyrica. Lyrica is sometimes used in combination with it, but the issue with Lyrica, or pregabalin is the generic term for it, is it usually has to be started at very low doses and gradually increased, because a lot of times too much is given at once. It can make someone very drowsy and make them feel somewhat uncomfortable. They can't focus. They sit down. They fall asleep. And that's not really good either. You don't want someone who's dopey all the time.
No.
There are other medications that can be used as well in conjunction with it. One of them is called Tramadol. Is a generic name. Tramadol is a weaker type of opiate pain medication. There's no addictive potential for it, but it does help when used in conjunction with acetaminophen or Tylenol. It can help mitigate some of the pain. There are combinations of acetaminophen or Tylenol and Tramadol together.
What is that? I mean, Anita medicine. Is it an anti-inflammatory?
No, it's not an anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
It's more for pain management per
okay.
se. So it's, given that she's having reactions to anti-inflammatories, we want to try and avoid the anti-inflammatory for now and try other things. So tramadol is more for pain relief. You would use that with the Tylenol. It's used as a, it comes as a combination medication. The brand name for that is called Tramicet.
Tramadex?
That can be also another one. There's different names, different companies make it. I really don't like using brand names if there's multiple companies, but nevertheless, that's one thing you can use. You can use Lyrica in combination. Another one which is available, and insurance companies will cover it, but the government will not, is something called Sesamet.
How do you spell that?
C-E-S-A-M-E-T. M-E-T.
N-E-P.
N-E-T, Sesamet. So Sesa, C-E-S-A, and then Met, M-E-T.
M-E-T, okay.
Yeah. And this particular medication is what we call a cannabinoid receptor blocker. And although it sounds familiar, it's an analog of cannabis or marijuana, but it's not really, doesn't give you the same overall effect. You don't get the munchies, it simply binds to cannabinoid receptors that are involved in pain management. And so again, this is another medication that used in conjunction with others might help provide her with a little bit more relief. And again, all medications, regardless of how benign they are, you always start at low doses and you gradually increase, usually every 4 or 5 days, depending on a person's response.
Yeah. Okay. So that sounds good already, because nothing was really recommended that I know of for her to take other than the Tylenol, and that really is not.
Yeah, and she's going to suffer for nothing. You know, there's other things to try, at least to try to see if that helps.
I think it would help already with what you've told. And mostly, as you said, it doesn't cause nerve damage if it's at a low.
It's usually managed conservatively. There are instances, if surgery needs to be done, it's when someone starts to lose function. They can't walk, their leg gets weak, that kind of thing. But if she's able to walk, and albeit slowly, if she can walk, then really not much to do other than trying to get her to exercise a bit more. That is just more mobility, and also controlling the pain, which will help her move more. And it gets a vicious circle upwards where she ends up recovering.
So use of a cane or whatever.
Yeah,
would be
anything
helpful.
Anything that helps her, I would go for it.
Yeah, thanks very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome.
You've really relieved a lot of pressure on what to do with this, because when you read about it in the various internet, etc.
I know. Well, I wish you all the best, Bill, and your wife as well. And we'll be back, 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in about 3 minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're heading right back to the phone lines. And good afternoon to Tony in Ottawa.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I wake every morning when I go to sleep at night, after 6 to 8 hours sleep, my right hand, it's very sore, like a pen, and I don't sleep on it. Even when I sleep on my back or opposite, I still wake up. It's like an alarm clock kind of thing.
No,
you have it every 5 to 6 to 8 hours sleep.
Is the hand numb? Is that what is pain?
Pain. It's hard to explain it. It's kind of like, it's not numb or nothing, but it's kind of like a very sore.
No.
It's kind of like writer's cramp.
Okay, now which is it, the entire hand or is it a specific?
Whole hand, from the wrist to the fingertips.
So all the fingertips?
Yeah, from the wrist to the fingertips. It's like it wakes me up every, I have 6 to 8 hours sleep. It's like an alarm clock, but it's like writer's cramp.
Okay. Well, the first thing I would do, especially with pain, if it's only from the wrist downwards, that would eliminate any damage to any nerve above the level of the wrist, right?
Okay.
Because it's from the wrist downwards, the rest of the arm does not hurt you. So then the next step would be, okay, let's evaluate the nerves that are running into the hand from the wrist to see if any of them are being damaged or compressed.
Okay.
Because if you're getting pain in your hand, when we sleep at night, regardless of our position, what we tend to do is we tend to bend our wrists. Wrists inwards, and just when we're sleeping, it's just a normal position to have for our hands. And when we do that, we can sometimes compress the nerve that runs through the wrist, and that can give you that pain. It can take time, and that's why, you know, 6 to 8 hours later, you have this pain in your hand that wakes you up. So ultimately, there's two steps to do. The first is first have the hand looked at by your physician, just to look for any, if there's any obvious signs of any anatomical damage. Sometimes when you look at the wrist and you press on certain areas of the wrist or tap on it, you can sometimes get that pain generated again. So it helps you identify possibly what nerve is involved. The second test to do is something called an electromyogram or EMG. And what this will do is it will measure how the nerve conducts a signal, in this case the electricity that goes down the nerve, how well it conducts the signal from your arm into the hand. And if there's any damage to the nerve that exists today, what this particular test will show is that the signal will slow down in the nerve that's affected, and it helps diagnose exactly what's going on. So those are the two things that I would do right now, especially since it's only one hand. It's your right hand and not your left. That tells us that there's likely something damaged in the wrist. And now the next step is to do those couple of things I mentioned to be able to identify exactly which nerve is being affected.
Okay.
So I hope that was helpful for you, Tony.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
All the best. Bye-bye now. 521 Talk, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And over to line 4 and Garnet in Ottawa. Good afternoon. Garnet, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hello, Dr. Rorkin. What I was wondering is, I did call you before.
Yes.
I have a hip to be replaced.
Yes.
Eh? And are you hearing me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And so what's happening now is I went to, and I had a use. You said to me, well, for sure, go ahead with it. It's
mm-hmm.
worth it, you know.
Yes.
And so anyway, I went to a doctor at the Riverside, and he gave me an injection in it. And it lasted for about 4 months. It wasn't too bad.
Okay.
Well, then I kind of suffered for another month or so.
Mm-hmm.
And my doctor, who is going to do the hip, he said, well, I'll send you to the down to the general.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, they'll x-ray it while they give you another injection.
Right.
So anyway, that was okay. But, oh, boy, it was really a painful
yes.
process.
Yeah, it
before,
is.
The other one was nothing that I got at the...
Yeah, they really go deep to try and get to inject into that joint
yeah,
space.
Yeah, but it went all down into my leg,
mm-hmm.
and it just really... But anyway, what the question I have is, now, that was done, I had it done the first time back on June the 18th, and now we're of 10.
Right.
And now we're into 11.
Yeah.
And another couple months, it's going to be a year. Now, I was just wondering, from your past experience,
mm-hmm.
Should I be getting around to the time where I'd be getting a call or
usually
something?
If it's been a year since you've been scheduled for a hip replacement, you should have heard something by now.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm just sort of thinking. So I think I'll get in touch with my doctor.
Yeah, I would give them a call to find out.
Give them a call and tell them. Actually, when he did look at me and everything like that, and I called his office, and they said, oh, we never even scheduled that hip needle, which I got on November the 8th. It
right.
lasted for about 4 months.
Yeah.
And now the last month, I've been kind of, you know.
Yeah, it provides temporary relief.
In fact, I'm going on a cane right now.
Yeah.
It's quite serious.
Yeah, so your quality of life is suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I was just wondering, like I know there's waiting time, and like I wish it was like your guest that was on there.
Yeah.
I wish it was like over in some of these other countries
yeah,
where
it's
you
really
could
quick.
Go in today, and well, you know they're going to diagnose it, and within a few days there's something done, eh?
Yeah.
But
my question is, Garnet, did you go to the knee and hip joint assessment clinic at all, or was this done separately just through an orthopedic surgeon?
No, I went to the Riverside.
Oh, you did? Okay.
There,
Yeah.
And when this doctor injected the needle and everything, you had to do it about six times, but I never felt nothing. I felt absolutely nothing.
Right.
And then after that, I felt real good for about 4 months.
Yeah.
Oh, geez, maybe he's cured it, you know.
But,
and then, oh boy, it came back bad. Right. Well, then my doctor out at the Civic,
yeah,
which is, I guess, the sort of the clinic at the Civic,
right,
for hip and knee and everything like that. And this doctor said that he would, you know, he looked everything over and stuff like that. And he looked at I had some CT scans,
yeah,
and he looked at them and he said, well, and the other, my general practitioner and the doctor out at the Riverside and him, they said, it's just bone rubbing on bone. Well,
yeah,
I said,
so
did you repair it?
Fixed,
and they
yeah.
said, well, no, it's actually gone a little bit mushroom shape, you can see there.
Yes, it's
and
grinding
said,
away.
It's definitely got to be replaced.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, I feel it's been quite a while.
Yeah, I would make some noise, Garnet, and say,
oh,
what's
good,
going
10
on?
Months now since yeah. I actually started with them.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking it should be coming up soon.
Yeah, I would make some noise and find out what's going on. Aside, instead of assuming that they're going to call you, I think it's probably better for you to call up and find out what the story is.
Yeah, well, I just didn't know what, you know, I thought, well, you'll have an idea how long it takes.
You should have heard something at least by now, especially
yep.
11 months later, at least giving you an indication of when you're going to have this done.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Doctor.
You're welcome, Garment.
Okay.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break for the news. When we come back, we have Jan in Ottawa, wants to talk about changing healthcare. And also, other lines are available at 521-TALK, 521-8255, *588 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And going right back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Jan in Ottawa.
Yes, good afternoon, Doctor.
Hi.
At the risk of sounding redundant, I would like to add my voice to
sure.
much of the sanity that has been injected in your comments today.
Thank you.
I don't know why it has become such a political football and paranoia among the population that the minute we talk about not only changing it, but improving it and helping it to survive, nobody wants to talk about it. I'm just wondering if it will take some of our politicians to summer up a dose of courage and get the problem out front. Look at it objectively, and as you quite aptly, and I wholly agree, some of the European systems are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
They're working. Nobody's left in the dark. Everybody gets service, and those who can afford it are willing to pay for it. And I think we mm-hmm. have the same thing in Canada here. And it's not just the seniors. They keep talking about seniors. Much as a lot of them hate to admit it, and I'm one of them, I will admit it, a lot of seniors are actually quite well off.
Mm-hmm.
Although not all paupers have had a good life, have managed to put money aside, and they would be prepared to either subscribe to a two-tier insurance, however you want to call it, but there has to be changes. I think you're quite right. What I find distressing is some of the calls that were in this afternoon, and one lady particularly, this blanket trashing of the so-called or incompetence,
mm-hmm.
doctors and nurses. That I find is extremely distressing and very unfair, because we really do have excellent service, medical service in this country. I can attest to that personally from friends and family and myself. And one of the problems seems to be, of course, the usual complaint about emergency.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there a couple of times with real emergencies.
Right.
Trust me. When it's a real emergency, you don't wait.
No, they see you.
I mean, triage pulls you in there so quickly, you can't blink your eye.
Mm-hmm.
If you're sitting there with a kid who has the sniffles, Well, I'm sorry, you shouldn't be there anyway. And if you have to wait 5 or 6 or 10 hours, well, that's just too bad. I mean, it sounds draconian, I know, but that's where the problem is. The system, I think, is abused and overused and improperly used.
I think that you raise a very good point, Jenna, that there certainly are aspects to the system that make it very easy for people to access it when they don't really need to.
I agree. And that's where a lot of the problem, it's not just a problem.
Right.
But the business about trashing the quality of care, I think, is really unfair. And doing the doctors and nurses a disservice, because we really have quite a fantastic service. Now, can I go to a personal medical problem?
Sure.
I would like to, I have been recently diagnosed with vasculitis,
mm-hmm.
which scares the daylights out of me, obviously.
Okay.
I've got a lot of the information. I will have more details with a more precise diagnosis
soon,
because it's an umbrella. I understand it's an umbrella condition, and there are all kinds of different aspects.
Right.
I don't know quite yet. I haven't had a chance to get the answers of what I have to look at down the road. But I'm very concerned, and I know that I have to take that I'm now in prednisone. I'm
mm-hmm.
reacting well to a low dose, but I think it will have to be increased. And I wonder if you can maybe give me some little idea of what do I expect down the road, a year, 2 years, 3 years from this with vasculitis?
Well, vasculitis, as you correctly mentioned, Jen, is that it is an umbrella thing, because there are different types of vasculitis.
Yes. And I should know that by next week.
Right.
Yeah.
And so depending on the type, that will also give you a prognosis, because there are many what we call vasculitides is the other term when talking about this, that can be very well controlled with medications and prevent a lot of damage. The main things we always are concerned about when there is vasculitis, which implies inflammation of the arteries, is which arteries are affected and where they're going. So, for example, if you have an arteries going to the kidneys, are they going to cause damage to the kidneys? Those that are going to the brain, will that cause any damage that way? To the eyes, distal extremities, pretty much anywhere arteries go, we want to know what type of vasculitis it is, because each one has its own specific anatomy that it will affect. That being said, the usual mainstay for treatment for vasculitis is to suppress the immune response that leads to the inflammation of those arteries.
Yes, I understand that.
So that's where prednisone comes in. The difficulties, though, is when you're using prednisone over the long term, there are long-term consequences.
Yes.
And again, it can be dose-related, but nevertheless, it's still things to be concerned about, right? There's the effect on the hip. It can cause damage to the hip, damage to the corneas of the eyes. It can cause cataracts. That kind of thing, there are many things that prednisone will do over the long term. It's a great drug short term. It's almost like a miracle drug short term. But long term, that's where the issue remains. But there are other immunosuppressive type medications that do not have the same side effects. All medications have side effects, but don't have the same degree of side effect as prednisone, and can also control the vasculitis. So the conundrum that we have right now in terms of determining what's going to happen is needing the diagnosis.
Excuse me, just to butt in for a minute.
Sure.
One thing that I was told, and I'll get more confirmation, more elaboration on that next week, I believe there's already a minor nerve damage in the feet.
Okay.
The ankles and feet. That has come through already.
Right, and that's usually the result of the small arteries that deliver oxygen to those tissues being compromised. And so very similar to diabetics, when they get the numbness in the feet, in this case it's the high blood sugar levels that damage the tiny arteries, plug them up, blood flow doesn't get down there as easily, and the nerves start to be compromised because of that. So it's very similar. The difference, though, and this is where there is much more potential benefit, is that unlike diabetic neuropathy, where the arteries can get permanently damaged, this is inflammation. And so the inflammation can be reversed. So hopefully they'll be able to reverse that process and reverse some of that tingling and discomfort you're having in your feet. It likely won't completely reverse it, but it certainly... you have a much better chance of doing it this way than if you had diabetic neuropathy.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to look in a crystal ball, but can you give me some sense of, and I'm assuming that in some cases the prednisone has to go on for life or other medication.
Mm-hmm.
How, to what extent should I be concerned about, I'm concerned obviously, but about the quality, the kind of life? Right now I have a great quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mobile, I'm active, and so on. The deterioration, well, of course, it's going to be controlled, obviously.
Right.
And I'm not looking for longevity here. I'm just looking for some idea. Do I change my lifestyle? Am I going to have to make a lot of changes in my life in a year, 2 years, 5 years? What do we look at in something like this? Can we even guess?
Well, I can tell you on the basis of the type of vasculitis, what the outcomes are. Yeah. So, for example, and if you have a pen handy, I can give you the names of the ones that have a very good outcome, that where it's very good for certain ones. So, for example, something that we call pure hypersensitivity vasculitis, giant cell arteritis,
mm-hmm.
or something called Henoch-Schönlein purpura, those have good outcomes. And those patients that have something called polyarteritis nodosa or
yeah.
something called Wegener's
yes.
Have 5-year survival rates of about 60 and 70% respectively. So still good outcomes.
I'm sorry, so it has what?
60 and 70% 5-year survival rates. For
okay.
polyarteritis nodosa, it's 60% and
yeah.
Wegener's is 70%. So still reasonably good outcomes, and they have to be aggressively treated.
Yes.
But again, many other of the vasculitis or vasculitides have good outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it does usually require prednisone first and then using other immunosuppressive agents to try and keep things at bay. But again, it really depends, and this is where it's so important, it really depends on what the diagnosis is.
Yes, and I think that's what we're
right.
working on. I mean, I can attest to the fact that I'm in the hands of very excellent doctors.
Good. Excellent. That's excellent.
And but I just wanted your take. I always enjoy your calls very much, and I wanted your take on it. You've given me some good answers, and I'm not going to tie up the line for any longer. I'm sure other people are waiting to talk to you. But I do want to thank you, and anything you can do to help to sort out the medical problem, the healthcare problem, would be great, because it really is needed, and I think you're right. It's going to collapse if we don't do anything about it.
Well, thank you very much for your comments, John. It's much appreciated.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye
right.
now.
Bye.
And we're going to take a small break and come back with your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. Our lines are available, so if you call, you will get on. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. Also want to bring up some very interesting news from this week in Europe. What's going on there with a severe measles outbreak, and we'll get into why that has occurred if you already don't know. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And in Europe this week, Europe, especially France, has been hit by a major outbreak of measles. And this actually is quite alarming in terms of the number of children that are being affected. In all of last year, in 2010, and even this was too much, in Europe, in France, there were 5,090 cases of measles. Now, to give you an idea of how many measles outbreak or measles cases there should be in a given year in a country that vaccinates appropriately, should be zero. This was 5,090 in all of 2010. In the first 3 months between January and March of this year, there have been 4,937 cases in France, and in all of Europe, 6,500 cases. And the World Health Organization has been stating that this is due to the failure to vaccinate all children. and that there has been a buildup of children over the course of the years that have not been immunized, and now the level of immunization in the population has been reduced so much that the disease literally can bounce from child to child. And these were young people between the ages of 10 and 19. So they're the ones that are getting sick. They haven't been getting immunized as they should, and now they're developing measles. And to keep in mind the complications of measles, one in every 15 children that are infected develop complications that can include pneumonia, seizures, and encephalitis. It's not a benign disease. And this clearly illustrates how the story about autism and MMR in 1998 has resulted in fear amongst parents for vaccinating their children. And now, because of the many years of not vaccinating, we're now seeing dramatic increases. And this is dramatic, ladies and gentlemen, when you have 6,500 people developing measles when zero should. So just thought I'd keep you apprised of what was going on in Europe. And in fact, now the disease has become so widespread in Europe in recent years that travelers have occasionally exported the disease to the United States and Africa. So Europeans coming here are bringing measles to us. Just thought you might want to know about that in terms of looking at evidence of what happens when you do not vaccinate. We're going to go to line one and welcome Eddie from Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hi, doctor.
How are you?
Good. Happy Easter.
Thank you. You too.
I had a gout.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me indoctomycin.
Okay.
And after it didn't work, they gave me colchicine.
Colchicine. Okay.
Yeah. It took 4 weeks mm-hmm. for the swell to go down.
Yes.
And now I'm okay.
Okay.
But what am I supposed to do for a long run?
Well, in terms of gout, the first thing to do is to, I would do a blood test just to see what your uric acid level is.
Yes, it's 512.
So that's high.
That's high.
So then you have to look at your diet and look for, look at the foods that you're eating. Foods that are high in protein, for example. So red meat will definitely contribute to increased levels of uric acid. Alcohol can sometimes contribute and actually does contribute to elevated uric acid levels. Having high blood pressure sometimes can increase uric acid levels as well. So there are dietary restrictions that usually will come into play.
They test no blood pressure, no diabetics.
Good,
nothing.
Good. So in effect, we're looking at trying to alter your diet. And all you have to do is, if you just go onto the internet, you can just look up uric acid and diet or gout and diet. And what will come up is a list of all the foods that can contribute to increased levels of uric acid.
Yes, I did that.
Okay.
I had, they told me red meat and lentils.
Yes.
It's high liver.
Yeah, high protein foods will do that.
Yeah, but do I have, this is for, now this is changed forever? Or?
This is pretty much forever.
Okay.
The reason is because when your body breaks the protein down, part of the metabolic process of breaking down protein is to produce uric acid. That's what the body will do. And so in your situation, your body tends to make more uric acid. It's a genetic predisposition. It's not something that you did to yourself. It's just the way your body works. And unfortunately, the uric acid level builds up and can lead to these gouty attacks. So ideally, prevention is the best way to go. You've had one gout attack, usually for people who get multiple gouty attacks. So if they get, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 attacks within a year, then you look at using a medication to suppress uric acid production. That medication is called allopurinol, and it is used to keep that level down. But you really reserve that medication for people that have recurrent attacks of gout and not just one attack, because you don't want to use medications if you don't have to.
Okay. They said liver. It comes out of liver. So there's no problem with my liver?
Well, it's not a problem with the liver. It's the fact that when your body breaks down protein, it normally will make uric acid. Everybody has that.
Okay.
It's just that your body likes to make more of it. But it's not that there's any damage to any organ. Your liver is, there's nothing wrong with the liver. It's simply the fact that in terms of how you metabolize protein, your body makes more uric acid than another person, and that's why you get the gout attacks. But it's
more
not,
exercise would help. I mean,
exercise helps everything, but I don't know if it's going to help prevent gout. I wish I could tell you that it would, but I can't tell you that. But exercise is very helpful.
I guess I will follow because the pain was terrible.
It's pretty it's pretty uncomfortable. Absolutely, Eddie.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Bye bye now. And over to line two, and good afternoon to Joe in Vanier.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin. My question is about blood circulation during atrial fibrillation. Is which major organs are affected by perhaps by ineffective functioning of the heart?
Oh, I see. So if your heart is not working well, what is affected?
Yeah. I'm concerned mainly about the brain.
Okay. Now, with regards to what's happening with the heart, is this congestive heart failure or what condition of the heart is?
Atrial fibrillation.
Oh, atrial fibrillation. Okay. Well, with atrial fibrillation, the organs are not going to get damaged. Okay, because your blood pressure, your heart will still pump. It's still pumping normally. The difference, though, is that because the upper chambers of the heart are not contracting regularly, they're sort of writhing around, you can end up with blood that pools and forms a clot in the heart. And if a clot forms in the heart and then the small chambers of the heart decide to pump normally, it could push that clot through the heart, and that's where it could end up going to the brain, leading to a stroke. So usually for atrial fibrillation, depending on, we do what's known as a CHAD score, a CHAD, C-H-A-D. That score tells us whether somebody needs to be on a treatment to thin their blood. And if that's the case, that medication dramatically reduces the risk of a stroke from atrial fibrillation. But in terms of organ damage and lack of blood flow to other organs, you don't usually see that with atrial fibrillation at all, because the heart...
Is it possible even in principle, even slightly?
Unlikely. The most common place that a blood clot will go from the heart is up into the brain. It because of the anatomy in the neck, the major arteries there are, you've got your carotid arteries that run straight up into the neck, and it's more likely to follow that flow than the ones into the arms. So that's where the clot tends to go. But again, if you use medication, in this case there are two medications now for atrial fibrillation. One is warfarin and the other is called Pradax or dabigatran. Those two medications can be used to dramatically reduce the risk of stroke for somebody that has atrial fibrillation. But in terms of other organs that are affected from atrial fibrillation, very, very rare indeed.
Yes, thank you. The other drug you mentioned, that's the one more, that's the more expensive.
That's correct.
But still, my question remains, the inefficiency does not cause oxygen deprivation.
No, it doesn't. And the reason is that the main part of the heart, the ventricle, which is the big part, the large chamber of the heart, is functioning normally. It's pushing blood through the way it's supposed to. The atria, or the small chambers, are not responsible for ensuring proper blood flow.
Okay.
So we have to go, Joe. But thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Bye bye now. And that wraps up our show. We've got 7 seconds left. So all I'm going to say is, everyone have a great week. Think about healthcare, what you want to do with regards to changes, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.